Hello and welcome to the Lancet's In Conversation With podcast. I'm your host, Chloe Wilson, and it's our March 30th issue. This week, we have an educational podcast discussing heart failure with preserved ejection fraction following the publication of a seminar on this topic. I'm joined by two of the authors from that seminar, Patricia Campbell and Franz Rutten.
Thanks so much, Chloe. I'm Dr. Patricia Campbell. I'm a consultant cardiologist working in Northern Ireland, and I'm the clinical lead for heart failure in this region.
Fantastic. Thank you. And then over to Franz.
Yeah, my name is Franz Rutte. I'm a GP and a professor in primary care and working on cardiovascular topics, notably heart failure, for over 25 years.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And to jump into the questions then for our listeners, I was hoping that you could both explain to me, firstly, what are the categories of heart failure and what is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
I will take this question. So, there are three categories of heart failure, and those are based on left ventricular ejection fraction. So we have HFrEF, or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, with ejection fraction below 40, mid-range ejection fraction 40 to 50, and HFpEF with the ejection fraction above 50%. And HFpEF is at least as common as HFrEF and HFmrEF together, and it seems relatively on the increase compared to the other two types of heart failure. And importantly, that relative increase is driven by advancing age and female sex and comorbidities.
Okay, and then how many people does heart failure with preserved ejection fraction affect compared with the other types of heart failure? Is it more common? Is it less common?
Yeah, so it's more common depending on which, let's say there's still some differences between epidemiological studies, but it's about 60% compared to 40% of the other types of heart failure.
Okay, and you mentioned a little bit, alluded to it in your previous answer, but who is most at risk for developing heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
Yeah, so the main people who are at risk are those with obesity, hypertension, and diabetes. But there are also other risk categories, patients with chronic coronary artery disease, and notably INOCA, so with non-obstructive coronary artery disease, but also people with atrial fibrillation, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, sleep apnea, anemia, or renal impairment. So a lot of, comorbidities can drive, can create heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, and inflammation seems to be a central mechanism in the pathogenesis.
So, Franz, you said about 60% of people potentially have heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. But what do the current estimates sort of suggest that the prevalence is globally, and how trustworthy are these estimates? You know, for example, are there any differences between the quality of the estimates for high-income countries and lower-middle-income countries?
Yeah, very good question. So, there are still some doubts around those numbers. So, in general, it's mentioned that about 1 to 2% of the population has heart failure. So, and of those 1 to 2%, so about 60% is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. But there's even as large a number of people who are not yet recognized as heart failure patients, and those are mainly patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So we can also find numbers when they include those unrecognized population of up to 3 to 4% of patients with heart failure. And so in that unrecognized population, the HFpEF relative population is 80%. So it's mainly HFpEF patients that remain unrecognized. So there are no real good epidemiological data from low-income countries. But importantly, what we know is that there, especially the prevalence and severity of hypertension is higher in low- and middle-income countries compared to high-income countries. and hypertension, of course, especially long-standing and high severe hypertension is a main contributor to have PEF. So we see also that at least what we know of data is that the HFpEF population in lower middle-income countries is younger. So the disease starts at an earlier time in their life course. So it's also an important disease in lower and middle-income countries. Sure.
And how much do we know about the physiology of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction? Do we know why some people end up with a reduced ejection fraction, whereas for others it might be preserved?
To compare those is that the key problem for developing the heart failure with reduced ejection fraction is like, let's say, a myocardial infarction. The heart is not able to in a short time to compensate or accommodate, then you get eccentric remodeling, and in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, it's more often long-standing comorbidities that cause the heart to compensate. The heart properly managed that to do so for 10 or even for 20 years, but eventually with concentric remodeling, it causes also heart failure simply because it cannot fill adequately with blood, and thus also has a reduced stroke volume simply because it cannot fill itself adequately. So it's a rather different mechanism. So in HFrEF, the problem lies mainly in the heart directly, and with HFpEF, it's more caused by the adaptation that doesn't fulfill adequately its role eventually.
I understand. Thank you for that. And in terms of diagnosis, how would you go about diagnosing with someone with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction? What kind of symptoms would people usually present with?
Yeah, I think for it is important to realize that certainly for HFpEF, the main symptoms are shortness of breath and reduced exercise tolerance. And the problem with that is that, of course, a lot of diseases can cause shortness of breath. Over 30 diseases can cause shortness of breath, especially in the elderly. Although eventually in those above 65, for instance, 70% of cases, it's either COPD or heart failure. So that makes life a bit more easy, but the problem is this: that it's not very very specific symptoms, and eventually in HFpEF, it sometimes takes some time to develop, let's say, signs of fluid overload. Certainly, a patient with hypertension, when they use diuretics, it's not evidently that they have ankle edema or crackles when you investigate the pulmonary, the lungs. So then a third problem is that quite some mimicking diseases. So COPD can mimic the symptoms that in the beginning of HFpEF, but also type 2 diabetes. What makes it for the GP problematic is that the echocardiography is not ready at hand. So it can use, of course, natriuretic peptide. So that's a good thing to realize. So to use, let's say, to keep a low threshold to start with measuring NT-proBNP. Although 80% of the patients with HFpEF have increased levels. You can miss about 20%, but at least you can catch 80% of those with HFpEF. So I think that is also a good take home messages for GPs that to lower the threshold to measure this simple blood test.
So as a GP, if somebody came in, what might make you suspect heart failure? And possibly with preserved ejection fraction, and then what would be the first you know, a couple of investigations that you would do as a GP?
Yeah, so for me, it's anybody who has shortness of breath. Even people, patients who are known with COPD or when they have diabetes, always suspect that, because those also drivers of HFpEF, also always suspect that it's yet unrecognized heart failure that can be causing the increase in shortness of breath. And especially when I always ask patients to compare with people of the same age, whenever they are less capable to do their things like walking or shopping or whatever, then they're people of the same age, then that should be a trigger that's something wrong. And then the first thing is, of course, you do your investigation, but those mainly are, let's say, related to fluid overload. So sometimes you don't find crackles over the lungs, you don't find ankle edema. Nevertheless, I would say, take a blood sample and of course look for things like anemia or renal EGFR, whether the renal function is okay, but certainly to measure the NT-proBNP. So whenever that's elevated, then you can start up with other things like EKG but you should already think about referring for echocardiography. So NT-proBNP is really the driver to come to the diagnosis.
I see. And then at what sort of point would you be referring them into, you know, to secondary care, into hospital management? Have you found that there's any difficulties between managing people in primary care and then the transition to services in secondary care?
Yeah, there are certainly problems. So, and there are differences between healthcare systems. So in the Netherlands, for instance, the waiting time for echocardiography is not as large as in the UK, but still there's quite some waiting time also when for open access facilities. So there is a barrier. A second barrier is that still not all cardiologists are really into HFpEF. So most HFrEF is much more known, and they are much more used to that and how to let's say treat those people than treating patients with HFpEF. So that's also a second barrier.
Thank you. And then moving on to, I wonder, how is HFpEF sort of commonly managed? I mean, in terms of non-pharmacological options and then also their pharmacological options.
Chloe, can I come back a little bit to how we diagnose it? Because I think, you know, I think as Franz very rightly said, you know, for all patients with shortness of breath or new exercise intolerance who have some risk factors, you'd be thinking, gosh, I need to rule out heart failure. And I think that's a big message we're trying to get across, is that we know that we're not recognizing it enough. We know that we're not picking it up enough. For example, here in Northern Ireland, our prevalence of heart failure is only 0.9%. And if we're to look at the data out there, as Fran said, it's way more than that if we're actually to do a screening process. So I think the threshold should be low to think about it. And then in terms of diagnostics, you know, to diagnose HFrEF in somebody with shortness of breath or HFrEF, that mildly reduced ejection fraction, is easy. All you need is symptoms and an echo showing that the EF is not normal. But HFpEF is definitely trickier. And that's the whole reason why we wrote this whole paper, because the diagnostic process itself is not simple. Now, we tried to make it as simple as possible. So we wrote a very simple stepwise algorithm, and it is based on the ESC guidelines and some published HFpEF risk scores. And for people in primary care or at early levels, non-consultant cardiology kind of specialist level, step one gets you the vast majority of patients diagnosed. But we've written the guidance to what to do for those people who can't be diagnosed at step one. But I think even step one, if you look at our figure two in our paper, you know, you need symptoms of heart failure. You need an ejection fraction of 50% or above. and you need a defining feature of heart failure. So you need either congestion by physical exam, as Franz had said, or in radiology, so an x-ray or CT done for another reason. And usually those patients will have an elevated NT-proBNP. Now, the ESC guidelines that we use are an NT-proBNP above 125 in sinus rhythm and above 365 for atrial fibrillation, because we know lots of factors up your BNP, including atrial fibrillation. And then the echo bit is where it's nearly the trickiest bit, because you need one or more defining features in echo. Now, I can list them here, but for the generalist, that's probably not something that you really need to know. And I suppose our recommendation would be, and our plea to champion, is that there are rapid access diagnostic services for heart failure, so that when you suspect somebody with symptoms, you get a BNP and you refer them in for a diagnostic pathway that's rapid, with experts at the other end reading these complex echo features to say, well, this looks like HFpEF or it doesn't. And then, you know, at that point, we will diagnose 80% of people. And for the people who we don't, we can then use the HFA-PEF score and the H2S-PEF score. And again, that will rule in or rule out a lot of those people. And it's the very, very tiny minority that you'd have to send on to a big quaternary center for consideration for things like exercise echocardiography or invasive filling pressures, either at rest or on exertion, to get a final diagnosis. So hopefully our figure makes it easier. But again, our message is that I don't think the generalist really has to know the ins and outs of these minutiae of echo reports, that there really should be a referral into heart failure services. And the plea again would be, as Fran said, a lot of cardiology services around the world don't even consider HFpEF. They're not commissioned in many parts of the UK, but the morbidity and the mortality for these people is as high in the real world as it is for HFrEF. Now, that wasn't the case in the clinical trials, but a wealth of real world data since then has shown the morbidity and mortality is as high. So surely they also deserve heart failure diagnostic and management services.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned these rapid access services for people with heart failure. Is that just within the UK, or are those services being rolled out more widely, do we know?
You know, I think it does depend on where you are and what is commissioned. And I think in a lot of places, like here in the UK, we have four devolved nations within the UK. There's a dramatic difference in what services are available. You know, Northern Ireland is definitely the poor cousin. We're almost a middle-income country rather than a high-income country, looking at our healthcare service. And for those services that are rolled out, it's done in the goodwill of people and trying to expand services to get people in very quickly. But it should be. And I do think increasingly across the world, we're seeing that, you know, we know that for many types of heart failure, and at the point of BNP, you don't know which type it is, your outcomes can be as worse, as bad as many cancer outcomes. So we are pushing that message out there that early diagnosis is critically important, and that rapid access clinics for diagnostics and management are critical.
Absolutely. Thank you. And then in terms of management, what is the best way to manage heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
So, you know, I think we've got pharmacological ways of managing this condition as well as non-pharmacological ways of managing the condition. So if we look at the latest ESE guidelines, there is only one class 1A recommendation for medication use in this patient population. And that is the SGLT2 inhibitors, dapagliflozin and empagliflozin. They're both 10 milligrams once a day, not requiring titration. And this is on the back of the EMPEROR preserved and the DELIVER trials, which showed a 20% reduction in the composite endpoint of cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalization. Now, it was mostly driven by heart failure hospitalization. So that is our class one life-saving, reducing morbidity therapy that we have. But we have two other big cornerstones that are equally as important for this condition. So loop diuretics for all patients with congestion. Now, what I'd say is that loop diuretics are the cornerstone, but we often add on diuretics for patients who remain volume overloaded despite increasing doses of loops. And we'll often use thiazides or thiazide-like diuretics. And occasionally we'll also use MRAs. Now, MRAs don't have a class one guideline and evidence base for their use, but often patients requiring increasing doses of diuretics will get hypokalemia, for example, and therefore an MRA is a good synergistic diuretic to use. But also on the back of sub-analysis of the TOPCAT trial, which looked at spironolactone in HFpEF. There were concerns about how that trial was run, and in the area where it was very robustly run and the patient group involved really did look like true HFpEF patients, there was very definitely a benefit. So I think many of us heart failure experts would have a very low threshold to use an MRA. And indeed, in the AHA guidelines, it is given a class 2B indication. So that's the diuretic cornerstone. And then the third kind of cornerstone for pharmacological care is that, as Franz eloquently explained at the start, this condition appears to be the downstream effect of a vast amount of comorbidities. And it behoves us to screen for and treat these cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular comorbidities. So hypertension, coronary artery disease, obesity, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, the list goes on and on and on. And we have a panel in our paper that will hopefully kind of guide you as to how best to treat those and what tips and tricks that we would advise. Now, there are no HFpEF specific treatments for those, but we often end up using some of the same medicines that we use in other heart failure conditions and cardiology conditions. So for example, ARBs are often used for hypertensive patients, and there is some evidence from the CHARM Preserve trial that that might help reduce heart failure hospitalization. So again, not a bad choice. ARNIs are occasionally used, and again, in the AHA guidelines, they're given a class 2B indication because again, subgroup analysis looked like patients may get benefit, particularly if they're female and their ejection fraction is not normal, so below the median of 57%. But important to note that there are no HFpEF specific treatments. But yes, you must look at the person as a whole and look at all of their comorbidities and aggressively treat them. So that's kind of the pharmacological aspect of it. And I think non-pharmacological is probably equally as important. And, you know, Franz and I being on here today as co-authors in this paper, I think speaks volumes to the fact that we really need seamless integrated care for these patients. It still remains that a vast majority of patients get diagnosed first when they end up in hospital, but the vulnerable points in their clinical care happen when they're transitioning from hospital to primary care, or they're in a general medical ward for another reason, because these patients have multiple non-cardiology comorbidities and their medications get changed and it's not communicated to the heart failure team or the primary care team well. And there's just not easy transition between care. And I think, again, as people who care about patients with heart failure, we would definitely be advocating for that and calling for improved seamless care pathway. And here in Northern Ireland, we're doing a big piece of work to try and improve that here. But I think that involves, yes, primary care, but it also involves our general medical colleagues, our physicians who care for people in the elderly age group. And I think physiotherapists and pharmacists, because polypharmacy is a big deal for many of these patients because of the amount of comorbidities they have and because of the advancing age of lots of this patient population. And we probably think that exercise training and cardiac rehab is good for these people. There is studies ongoing about that. But definitely we know that for patients that were hospitalized recently with a heart failure exacerbation, that exercise training on discharge helped in a recent trial, and half of those patients were HFpEF. So I think we have even enough data to suggest that there's probably going to be benefit from exercise training and multidisciplinary input.
I mean, we talked a little bit already about how management differs between people who are based in different regions, you know, dependent on these rapid access clinics and whatnot. And it sounds like how quickly somebody is able to be diagnosed and treated then will have a huge effect on prognosis.
Yeah, you know, we have very hard data for this for HFpEF. It's slightly less for HFrEF, but we do know that once patients are admitted with an acute exacerbation of their heart failure, their cardiac functioning and their overall quality of life and physical functioning never quite returns to what it was. So it is a chronic progressive condition. And so we would argue that, you know, and again, as I've said, at the point of the BNP being elevated, you do not know which type of heart failure this is. So all patients should have the same level of access. You know, here in the UK, we follow the NICE criteria of a BNP greater than 2000. We recommend imaging by echocardiography and specialist review within 2 weeks. And when it's between 400 and 2000, we'd recommend within 6 weeks. And I know lots of people are trying to do that, but because of case volume, sometimes it's really difficult. So again, I think it speaks to having access to the specialist, but if they don't have the capability of seeing them physically in the secondary centre, well, then why couldn't we do the diagnostics either in the centre and advise out to the community care, or have the diagnostics out in the community? And we see that working in lots of places. The Republic of Ireland, for example, has rolled that out very successfully. So I think diagnostic access is critically important for us to champion, and early medical therapy with class 1 SGLT2s and treatment of the comorbid states and congestion, because HFpEF patients tend to be more so than HFrEF patients, diuretic resistance, but get frequent AKIs. They are quite difficult to manage. They're arguably more difficult to manage than a HFrEF patient. So I think ensuring that we are non-discriminatory in our care for heart failure patients, it shouldn't matter what your EF is. You should still deserve the same level of care. And that's what we're trying to improve across the services that we work in and across the globe, because it impacts on the patient's quality of life, but also on their risk of heart failure hospitalization and mortality, which in turn impacts on the healthcare services and the costs at a time when across the world, healthcare services are in economic crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think those are some really good messages for our listeners to say that actually, you know, we really need to take heart failure with preserved ejection fraction seriously and is associated with, you know, potentially just as poor of a prognosis as people who have a reserved ejection fraction. So we also talked a little bit about the, you know, the benefit of multidisciplinary team working. And you mentioned a lot of people who might be involved in the care of a person with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And am I right in thinking there's, you know, been fairly good evidence, at least in the UK, for heart failure specialist nurses? And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on how clinicians who are working in these different areas can work, you know, together to improve care for somebody, you know, living with this condition.
Yeah, so I can start off. So I think GP has a very major role in diagnostic process. So considering at least heart failure in the treatment, it's the GP is more in a cooperative role, I think, especially in those with severely affected HFpEF. But also there also comes in a heart failure nurse and of course the cardiologist. So. As a GP, you also have, with the pharmacist, you have to cooperate. The communication is key, and so already mentioned by Patricia, how important this, whenever you change drugs or considering to change drugs, communicate whether what your intentions are. Do you want to up to trade or not up to trade, down to trade? So. Especially around medication, it should be as seamless as possible.
Yeah, and I think, Chloe, what you just said about heart failure nurses, you know, we have solid, hard evidence for the benefit of heart failure nurses as part of the MDT for HFrEF, or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Those studies have yet to be published for HFpEF. I think lots of us would, you know, innately feel that absolutely they would have a benefit, particularly because they are diuretic experts and experts in knowing volume status of patients. And in our own centre here, we actually look to say, oh, we actually have a nurse who's caring for patients with HFpEF. How well do they do compared to HFpEF patients who haven't seen our nurse? And we were surprised, but that even in our small centre, we were able to show definite marked reduction in heart failure hospitalizations and also mortality, which astounded me. But I suppose it's not surprising because the morbidity and mortality of these patients is equally as high as those for HFrEF, and why not have an expert involved in their care to help improve those outcomes? So I would hope that we'll have harder evidence for that, but certainly I think we would all agree with that. And as Fran said, I think the seamless care, heart failure requires lots of transitions and titrations of medications. That's difficult for patients. It's difficult when it's happening between secondary care and primary care. So we all have to work really, really hard at making sure the communication is clear.
And I was going to come on to asking whether there were any, you know, emerging new treatments for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, because you said, you know, many of the medications have almost been repurposed from, you know, a use in other types of heart failure.
Yeah, and I suppose we're going on to reuse other medicines for other conditions into heart failure. So the SGLT2s came from the diabetes world and is now across the spectrum of ejection fraction for heart failure. So, you know, in the obesity world, we all know about semaglutide, the GLP-1 receptor agonists. And there was a small study called STEP-HFpEF, which was utilizing semaglutide in patients with HFpEF and obesity. And it definitely led to a significant improvement in patients' quality of life and reduction of weight. Now, the naysayers might say, well, patients felt better because they lost weight. You know, they were able to exercise better and feel better. But you shouldn't see a reduction in BNP with weight loss. In fact, you might actually see the opposite. And there was a definite greater reduction in the NT-proBNP in the semaglutide group compared to the placebo group, and also a reduction in CRP. And we do think that inflammation plays a big role for many patients in HFpEF and the etiology and progression of HFpEF. So I think that's interesting. And there is the ongoing STEP-HFpEF diabetes trial and bigger trials to come. So that's an area that we might see more of in the future. And I spoke a little bit before about, you know, we looked at spironolactone in HFpEF before. It was a neutral trial, but there were issues with it. There are two ongoing trials, SPIRIT-HF with one R and SPIRIT with two Rs, both looking at spironolactone in HFpEF patients. And hopefully one of those will be reported early next year and the one the year after. So that's definitely going to give us a harder example of whether spironolactone will be useful in this condition or not. And similarly, the non-steroidal aldosterone antagonist of finerenone is being looked at in the Fine Arts trial, which hope we might hear at the ESC this year. So we are definitely looking at these MRAs for HFpEF now with a more concerted effort. And hopefully we'll see what we think is that these medicines may be of benefit. And then there are lots of kind of newer, you know, trials that are kind of earlier in their stages. There's the SUMMIT trial, which is looking at tirzepatide, and that's a dual molecule, which is an insulinotropic polypeptide and a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And that's looking at, again, patients with HFpEF and obesity. The Hermes trial, there's many centers around the world recruiting for that at the moment, and that's ziltivecumab. That is a monoclonal antibody against the IL-6 ligand. So it's being looked at for patients with HFpEF and concomitant inflammation. So we'll wait to see, does an anti-inflammatory medicine have an effect in HFpEF? But I think it is very important to say, in the care of HFpEF patients, there are certain treatments that you might think about stopping or reducing or withdrawing entirely. And so you need to look at, because again, a multimorbid condition with lots of medicines and polypharmacy. So the things that we would always say is loop diuretics, yes, they're the cornerstone for treatment of congestion, but again, for all types of heart failure, they're not life-saving. And often some of the other medicines we use are synergistic diuretic type agents. So our SGLT2s, ARNIs and MRAs, if they're all being used, you may actually need a lot less loop diuretic. We would also say if patients are starting to struggle with hypokalemia, consider using an MRA rather than supplementation. And that way you'll also be able to withdraw your loop diuretics. We know that lots of these patients are historically on nitrates for multiple reasons. And unless they've got active angina, the NEAT HFpEF trial showed that actually patients felt worse and did not improve their exercise tolerance on nitrates. So we would recommend withdrawing those. And then also there was a trial looking at beta blockers. And we don't think there's much evidence for beta blockers with an EF of greater than 50%. Now, obviously, if they're in fast atrial fibrillation, they'll need some rate control. But for treatment of the HFpEF itself, there is no data. And there was one trial actually showing that patients felt better and probably could move better when beta blockers were withdrawn. So I think that's important to think about medicines that we don't have to use. Which, do you know what? See, when I tell a patient, I'm going to stop one of those medicines, the hands go up, hallelujah, one last medicine to take. So I think that's an important message to get out. And then I do think we will have emerging evidence for our non-pharmacological therapies. So cardiac rehab, like I said, there is some evidence at the baseline there, but there's the Rehab HFpEF trial going on and the Reach HFpEF trial going on. So hopefully we will have some data from those. But we do know from the Secret trial that there, you know, caloric restriction and exercise training in patients with obesity and HFpEF definitely improved quality of life. So there's probably a role there that we'd probably have a bigger evidence base for soon.
Absolutely. And I mean, it sounds like there's lots of really exciting trials going on looking at pharmacological treatment as well as, you know, these non-pharmacological treatments like cardiac rehab. Do you know if there's much going on about digital innovations? I know there's been some, you know, some fairly good evidence for, you know, for self-monitoring, but I don't know if that's been more for people with reduced ejection fraction or what's going on in the preserved ejection fraction space.
Well, in terms of digital, you know, when I hear digital, I kind of think, ooh, well, are we going to start looking at AI models to try and phenotype these people so that we can try and individualize some therapies? And I think that has been looked at, and we are definitely able to cluster patients with heart failure into different phenotypes. Now, that hasn't as yet resulted in more individualized medicines, but it is ongoing and is going into the future. And I know that here in the UK, we're doing a HFpEF registry that will involve some biobanking, so that hopefully in the future we may be able to find that, oh gosh, for this particular person with these particular phenotypes associated with them, this medicine might be better. That's very much in its infancy. I think we're just delighted that back in 2020 and 2021 we got a medicine that was proven to work for HFpEF, but I do think that that is an ongoing pursuit for everybody who's involved in the care for HFpEF. I think remote monitoring for all patients with heart failure is beneficial. There's not been much to distinguish between HFrEF and HFpEF as of yet, but, you know, weight monitoring, I think, is critically important for patients to know when they have volume overload incipient. And we know that there's, you know, data for patients with invasive monitoring that can help know when volume status is coming up. And there are newer emerging technologies for that, different than, say, for example, the CardioMEMS, which is currently at the minute. You know, so I think that will be coming in the future. But for the patients to have ownership of their symptoms and to be able to alert the teams who can help them before they end up having to come to an emergency department and admitted to hospital has to be a good thing.
Thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm sure our listeners have taken away a lot of really good information. But I was just wondering if you had any final takeaway messages for anyone who is listening.
Yeah, maybe I can start. So I think the main issue is that as a GP, so you should have a low threshold to measure NT-proBNP. So do it in any person above 50, I would say, or above 60 with a shortness of breath. A second thing I didn't mention yet is that be aware as a GP that spirometry can be tricky. You can sometimes you think that spirometry it's obstruction caused by COPD, but the obstruction can also be caused by heart failure. So, and the third thing is that especially obese patients, and what we already mentioned, they are, let's say, they are at risk for developing HFpEF, but especially obese patients, they can have relatively low NT-proBNP levels. So when the NT-proBNP level in an obese person is yet normal, but you cannot explain the shortness of breath differently or otherwise, then nevertheless, you should consider echocardiography. Those are my main messages. I give it to Patricia.
Yeah, so I think following on from that, yes, HFpEF is tricky to diagnose. So we would definitely be championing heart failure diagnostic services with the experts trying to interpret those difficult echocardiograms for you because it is tricky. But hopefully with our figure, our stepwise algorithm, you'll see that step one, we will be able to diagnose about 80% of patients. And then the remaining 20%, a lot of those can be done through step two, which again will be at secondary care level. But again, I would reiterate Fran's message. You have to think about heart failure to diagnose it. So please have a low threshold to measure your NT-proBNP. And I suppose I'd just like to use the platform to champion heart failure diagnostic and management services for patients with HFpEF, including MDT care, because the real world data does show that the morbidity and mortality for these patients is as concerning for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So hopefully that message will be heard by commissioning services all across the globe.
Thank you so much to Patricia and Franz for joining me today. We've had some really great discussions about heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, and you can find the full seminar at thelancet.com and on our Lancet Clinic pages.